From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The president and the alt-right, a test of leadership. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point. After 2 days of demands for moral clarity from black leaders to conservative Republican senators, President Trump said this from the White House today.
Racism is evil.
He named the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazis as repugnant, but what he didn't say could still come back to haunt him. In Charlottesville over the weekend, white supremacists held their largest gathering in a generation, better organized than ever before. In the open carry state of Virginia, some law enforcement officials said they were outgunned. Racist leaders claim Mr. Trump's election has helped their recruiting, but he has yet to fully repudiate a growing movement. We'll look at the challenges to come. First, there's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24, or you can listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. From the White House today, President Trump delivered a new statement on racism, but only after he listed a few of his economic achievements. Then he turned to this weekend's events in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans.
Glenn Thrush is White House correspondent for The New York Times. Always good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Everybody was waiting for that statement we just heard on racism, and yet the president did begin by talking about economics and China and trade relations. Do you think he was reluctant?
Yeah. I think he really, it actually, Warren, very much echoed the way that he began his now infamous all sides remark in Bedminster on Saturday, when he began with a fairly long discussion of a veterans affairs issue and said, well, I guess we have to talk about what's happening in Charlottesville. It is very clear that he does not want to talk about this issue, even though the world very much wanted him to make this statement.
Do the people around him, his staff at the White House, the Attorney General and the head of the FBI that he met with today, do they want him to talk about it?
Yes, as does John Kelly, his chief of staff, who had advised him to put out a more fulsome statement. I think there's a contingent in the White House that wanted him to kind of hold the line. I think they quieted down over the last couple of days. And I think the president himself has shown the tendency, both as president and as a candidate, to not want to alienate this fringe part of his base. And I think in generally, from a cultural perspective, what he's trying to do is attack people on the other side of the aisle and leave his own base, which is shrinking, alone. So I think a lot of this has to do with the president's innate caution, his political strategy. But it's also a product of the fact that he has one of the lowest approval ratings of a president at this point in his term and seems to be suffering some erosion of his own base.
You mentioned the many sides statement that he made while he was in New Jersey about how there was violence on many sides, rather than singling out those, as he did today, who were racists. He got a lot of heat from that, from very conservative Republicans, Orrin Hatch and Marco Rubio and many others.
Well, Warren, let's just step back a bit and look at what the news of the day is. Newsrooms across the country are on fire right now, writing stories. Editors are jumping up and down. Reporters are banging away on keyboards to write that the president of the United States said that racism is evil. Doesn't seem to me like that's big news. But with this president and the way that he's comported himself in the last 72 hours, that is big news. So I think when we're looking at this, we have to look at the context of the fact that virtually everybody across the ideological spectrum who holds public office in this country condemned what they were seeing in Charlottesville, Virginia. And it wasn't a close call, Warren. I mean, these are people who are throwing urine at reporters and protesters, carrying swastikas, placards claiming that Jews were destroying the world, racist slogans, and from time to time, Trump-Pence campaign signs.
Okay, so the president took a long time to denounce all that this morning. He did not lose any time issuing a very nasty tweet about Kenneth Frazier. He's the black CEO of Merck Pharmaceuticals, one of the biggest companies in the country, who quit a federal panel in protest over Trump's long delay in denouncing racism. What was his tweet, the president's tweet?
The president's tweet was that he kind of conflated two things. He said that Mr. Frazier, now that he quit the business council, should have all the time in the world, and he used all capital letters, to lower drug prices, drug ripoff prices, I think was the expression that he used. Very interesting. I'll paint a little bit of a picture for you on what it looked like from when the reporters saw that tweet by the president. You know, we did not know, most of us are not business reporters, those of us who were traveling with the president on Air Force One this morning down from New Jersey to Washington, we did not know that the CEO of Merck was African American. So we're reading the tweet, and it seemed to be pretty newsworthy. And then one reporter who worked for a Business Wire pointed out that Mr. Frazier was black. And the stunned silence in the cabin among the reporters was really striking. It was just an absolutely amazing concept that the president, who is under pretty much universal condemnation for not calling out these protesters in Charlottesville, would instead go after one of the very, very most successful African American corporate CEOs in the country. A real moment in time, and frankly, the backlash against that was so extreme, I think he had no choice other than to issue these remarks today at the White House.
Okay. After, once again, he had spoken about trade and relations with China and talked about what he's going to do later today, which has more to do with that. Well, Glenn Thrush, it's great to have you on our program as always. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to talk to you.
White House correspondent for The New York Times. We're going to hear much more about all this and what the president faces and what the country faces in terms of the new alt-right movement. In a moment, we'll have more on the president and a test of leadership on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Alney back with To the Point. We heard President Trump today specifically name the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazis as repugnant. During the weekend in Charlottesville, the KKK's best-known leader, David Duke, talked to a reporter from NBC.
This represents a turning point for the people of this country. We are determined to take our country back. We're going to fulfill the promises of Donald Trump. That's what we believed in. That's why we voted for Donald Trump, because he said he's going to take our country back, and that's what we got to do.
The white supremacist forces in Charlottesville were the largest gathering of its sort in at least a generation. That's according to A.C. Thompson, who was there for ProPublica. A.C. Thompson, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Tell us more about what you mean by that, the largest gathering of its sort in at least a generation.
Yeah, so if you go back into the 80s and 90s, what you would see is groups like the Klan, the Aryan Nations, the World Church of the Creator, and these other type of white supremacist outfits gathering, having meetings across organizations. Most of these, by the way, were not even public gatherings. They were sort of private gatherings for the white supremacist movement. This is the biggest coming out publicly for these types of extremist groups in many, many years. And I would say it was a remarkable display of force, organization, and tactical savvy on the part of these extreme right groups.
Talk about the organization, if you will, and could it have been anticipated as long ago as Friday?
Yeah, look, if you were law enforcement on the ground in Charlottesville this weekend and you saw mass numbers of people coming into town bearing guns of all varieties, shields, helmets, bats, clubs, big flags with big flagpoles that could be used to beat people. And this had been broadcast throughout the white supremacist community through their websites and podcasts, like, hey, bring all these implements, including pepper spray as well. The police and law enforcement had to be aware that this was going to be an armed sort of event and a violent sort of event. They didn't take any steps to take those weapons and so forth away from anybody who was at the park on Saturday, even though they had, a tight perimeter set up, they had barricades set up, and they could have done that. They did not. They allowed all participants, whether they were far left or far right, to show up in basically battle gear and battle it out.
Well, isn't Virginia an open carry state?
Virginia's an open carry state, but hey, it's like this. If you're law enforcement and you have a group of people who are gathering for a rally in a public park, which you have heavily secured, you could say, you can't come in here with a big old crash helmet on, because we know what that's about. You can't come in here carrying a club. I saw people carrying 2-3 foot clubs. You can't come in here with a can of pepper spray. If you want to come into this public park, we're going to tell you, like, hey, put down your Nazi shield, because we know that this is about violence and we're not going to allow violence in this spot. I've seen that before at other protests. We've all seen that sort of thing before. And that was just not a tool that the law enforcement was using. For the far right groups, they had incredible timing. They had military style formations. They had leaders who were directing their members via headsets and handheld radios. And by and large, the white supremacists followed very closely the orders that were given by their various leaders.
Jack Roberts, stick with us for a moment, if you will, a few moments, again, with ProPublica. AC Thompson with ProPublica, because I want to introduce Zach Roberts. He's a freelance photojournalist who covered the white supremacist rally in Charlottesville on Saturday. Good to have you on our program as well. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the young man that you saw chased and beaten by the people that AC Thompson is telling us about.
Yeah, DeAndre Harris was basically, he's marching along and marching along the white supremacist march that was happening that actually went by the police station there. He's a 20-year-old kid who is a assistant special ed teacher in Charlottesville. He's lived there for a couple years. And he just, I guess, was a victim of the weekend, like so many people were, beaten with the clubs that you were describing there, AC, and also part of a parking arm that was broken when he was kicked and punched on the ground of a parking lot that was right next to the Charlottesville Police Department.
And he was African American, I take
it.
That appeared to be the reason.
A very important mm-hmm. definition, because I was standing there with cameras, and I didn't get beat up. So there was a purpose on why he got beat up, and say I didn't.
Where were the police?
That's a good question. I'm not quite sure. They as he was talking, the police are very very odd the way that they dealt with things. I mean, first off, when they cleared the Lee Park, Emancipation Park.
Emancipation.
They pushed all of the white supremacists into the counter protesters, into the Antifa protesters and the Black Lives Matter protesters. So in a very perplexing, push together, like trying to make them kiss or something. I don't know what happened, what the thought process there was. So, but from there they started marching, and then basically the police just kind of hung back and I guess kept protecting Emancipation Park or something. I don't know where they were, because it took a full 10 minutes or so after DeAndre was beaten, for the police, one police officer to even show up, an African-American sheriff showed up and kind of protected DeAndre for a little bit. But, I mean, the bigger question was it was the full – I had a runoff to go cover the kind of the larger story of Charlottesville, the terrorist attack by the white supremacist down the street from where DeAndre was beaten. But I waited there for 25, 30 minutes, and no ambulance showed up. And this was before the terrorist attack happened.
A little bit of background. Emancipation Park is the new name for Robert E. Lee Park. And the basic contention here has to do with the city's desire to take down that statue put up in the 20s, I believe. They still haven't decided what to do with it. A.C. Thompson, back to you. Does that sound like things that you saw as well during the incidents over the weekend?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As Zach was talking about that, I was thinking that we saw a similar incident before that on the other side of the park. We documented the team I was with on video where a group of white supremacists, many of them with the Vanguard America, lined up in military formation against a group of older, largely gray-haired, peaceful, anti-racist protesters, you know, holding signs that said stuff like, no hate, and just stormed at them and pummeled them, just absolutely pummeled them. We caught this all on video. We were watching as a whole phalanx of police officers just stood behind metal barricades and allowed this brutality to occur. And look, I've been in a lot of protest scenes. I've been in war zones. I've seen a lot of bad stuff. And I will tell you that this was some of the most ferocious and intimidating street fighting I have ever witnessed.
Did the police, as I think some of them said sort of offhandedly, say that they were outgunned?
The big problem really is that the police were not transparent about what their plans were with the public, and they were not transparent afterwards about why they took this tack. You know, the governor and local officials, state officials, had about a 13-minute press conference where they didn't take questions after the murder terror attack happened, after all the violence happened. And so it's still not totally clear to any of us, I don't think, about why they took this tack. But what I can tell you is we've seen sort of similar police tactics occur in other cities at these rallies. There were sort of similar stand down, stay apart, let the two sides fight it out tactics in Berkeley, California. There were sort of similar tactics last summer in Sacramento, California. 10 people were stabbed at that white supremacist gathering. So we've seen this before. And I understand that police have a need not to go smash a bunch of heads and violate people's civil rights and make the situation worse. But I think there's a certain question about, are we going to keep seeing open political warfare in the streets of America with little to no effective police intervention?
You mentioned a murder, and let us not forget that Heather Heyer was struck down. She was a local demonstrator, and when a young man from the organization you just referred to, Vanguard Americas, smashed into another car, that car knocked into her and others as well. Several people were injured. He now has been charged with second-degree murder. So, A.C. Thompson, one other question to you. You mentioned Vanguard America. That's one we haven't really heard much about, in addition to the KKK and the neo-Nazis and so on. Is this a really new organization, and are they putting the KKK sort of into history books?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to be clear. People who weren't there and don't study this stuff, they seem to think that this was all about the Klan and David Duke and earlier Nazi formations, and it really wasn't. David Duke was a minor role here. The Klan was a minor role. What we're seeing is the emergence of a new, very smart, very sophisticated, and very scary, frankly, white supremacist movement comprised of groups like Radical Agenda, Vanguard America, Identity Europa, True Cascadia, as well. There are some throwbacks like the National Socialist Movement, a Nazi party, the neo-Confederate group called the League of the South. But by and large, we are seeing a new white supremacist movement that's younger, meaner, and smarter. And that should be worrisome to people.
A.C. Thompson, experienced in covering these things for ProPublica, seeing something very new, very different, and very scary. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat is a history professor at New York University. She's also an expert on fascism. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How worried are you about what we have just heard from both A.C. Thompson and Zach Roberts?
I think everyone should be worried, both that these kind of politics have been so on the increase lately. They're appealing to more and more people. I think we should be worried about the stance that our president has taken. He has a lot of the responsibility for this. And I think there are background issues to do with gun policy and the GOP that are all coming to home to roost right now.
Tell us more about gun policy. What do you think that has to do with it, and how is it related to the Republican Party?
Well, it's no secret that the NRA and the GOP have been very good friends over the years. And from my point of view, I approach American politics from the point of view of European history and fascist movements. And I've always thought it was just sheer madness to allow groups and individuals to accumulate private arsenals. And it was only a matter of time that these people are going to get energized with the right people in power, the right president in particular. And now you have a situation that was described by your other guests where also that some of them were dressing up like National Guard, and it was very difficult to tell who is who. So one of the things that I believe, you know, Trump today, he came out and he made his kind of declaration that this has to stop, or rather that this is repugnant. And I see this as he's playing a long game with the NRA and the GOP. And after all, this is a man who in January 2016 said that he could stand on Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and he wouldn't lose any followers. So he weaponized himself and declared his, attitude toward guns very early. So he's been, you know, during his whole campaign, as early as fall of 2015, he was inciting these people. He was reaching out to them. He was retweeting swastikas and violent, you know, other violent messages. And he used this and fake black crime statistics. So what we have today with these people feeling energized and a new generation of people feeling that there's hope, as your other guest said, is in part because of this, and then the fact that, yes, Virginia is open carry, but this is a national problem, and the police don't quite know what to do with it. And so I really hope that with more rallies I hear are planned, I hope that there are serious conversations going on with all the public safety, different bodies and entities about what to do.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat, a history professor at NYU. David French is with us, senior writer, Conservative National Review. You have said that Trump needed to call out white supremacists by name. He named the Ku Klux Klan. He named the neo-Nazis. That was about it. Did he do enough?
Well, I mean, it was late, but let's just put it this way. It's a whole lot better than not doing it at all. I mean, imagine the conversation we'd be having if he was steadfastly and stubbornly still refusing not to call out these white supremacists. But, you know, I'm not surprised at his reluctance, because one of the facts that an awful lot of people have missed in this is that this alt-right movement was among his earliest and most enthusiastic supporters, beginning all the way from when he came down that escalator to announce his candidacy. The alt-right latched onto him and online went after Trump opponents with extreme viciousness.
Okay, I'm going to have to interrupt you. We need to take a break. We will come back. We'll hear more about all of this. David French and others, thank you for being with us so far. Back in a moment with this conversation on To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with To The Point, talking today once again about what happened over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia. And here is the mayor of that city. His name is Michael Signer. He spoke yesterday to CNN's State of the Union about the president's original response to what had happened, talking as he did about violence from many sides and not singling out the racist right as he did today.
Well, look at the campaign he ran. I mean, look at the intentional courting, both on the one hand of all these white supremacist, white nationalist group like that, anti-Semitic groups, and then look on the other hand, the repeated failure to step up, condemn, denounce, silence, you know, put to bed all those different efforts, just like we saw yesterday. I mean, this is not hard.
David French, back to you. I interrupted you. You're a conservative. You're at the Conservative National Review, and you were saying that among his earliest supporters were the people from the alt-right. Steve Bannon, obviously, in the White House, is still said to be very connected to them. What should happen?
Well, I mean, Steve Bannon connected to the point where he bragged, reportedly, at the Republican National Convention, that Breitbart, the publication he ran with a huge readership, was the platform for the alt-right. So, look, my view on this is pretty specific. It's one thing to say the right thing a couple of days later, which, again, it's better than not doing it at all. It's time to take action. And one of the things that has to happen, I believe, is you should not have a person who declared that his publication was the platform of the alt-right working so closely to the heart of power. I think Steve Bannon should go. Actions speak louder than words. But the president, you know, one of the problems here is the president's morality often seems to depend on how loyal we're, I mean, and president, the president's view of what's right and wrong is so centered around himself that he gives an enormous amount of latitude and grace to groups that supported him. And as I said, no one supported him, particularly online, more vociferously than the alt-right.
Did you get attacked by the alt-right for pointing that out during the campaign?
Oh, viciously. I mean, it was. And my story is not alone, but my youngest daughter, her picture was photoshopped into pictures of gas chambers. My wife's blog was taken over by images of dying and dead African-American men and women. We received death threats, hacks into our phone calls. And again, this is something that was happening not just to me, to other journalists. And we were raising the alarm and saying this was happening, but a lot of it was getting lost in a 2016 election that was frankly just, you know, one scandal after another day by day. It got lost in the noise and it shouldn't have been. And the events of this weekend are one reason why.
Was it called fake news?
No, it was just, you know, I think it was just passed over. I mean, there were some outlets who paid attention to the rise of the alt-right. There were some outlets who raised the alarm. But as a general rule, again, when you're talking about this incredible 2016 news cycle where you're lurching from scandal to scandal, it got lost in the background noise. And it was still lost in the background noise, unfortunately, when Steve Bannon was elevated to become the chief strategist in the White House. It needs to be in the foreground now. And the White House needs to cleanse itself, purge itself of any hint of alt-right influence.
Once again, of course, the instant concern is the removal of the Robert E. Lee statue, which Charlottesville has been talking about doing but has not decided whether to really do or not. That's what was the basis for all of this in the first place. Jamil Smith is a political journalist, contributing writer for The Daily Beast. Good to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Very interested in your take. Let's go back to the early part of our program today. The one person that President Trump has singled out by name so far is Kenneth Fraser, who was head of Merck. We heard earlier our reporter from the New York Times saying that the press corps didn't realize that he, the head of this extraordinarily large organization, Merck Pharmaceuticals, was in fact black. He quit in protest from what the president had said. And the president singled him out, said he should have time, he'll have more time now to lower rip-off drug prices. What do you think of that?
I think that the president seems to live in a zone where he simply just looks for the next fight. I think that's really kind of the combative nature that encapsulate every part of his presidency. But what we need to look at here is what he didn't say. And the thing is, you know, we could talk about, you know, the fact that he came out today and he issued a stronger statement, and that's all well and good. Yes, sometimes political pressure is necessary for people to even be at the very basic level humane in their judgment of racism. That said, he didn't say in either statement that he rejects the support of white supremacists, that he rejects the support of the Ku Klux Klan, of neo-Nazis, of neo-Confederates. And so while giving them a light rebuke, sort of a light slap on the hand, and saying that he's going to only investigate one incident, not the DeAndre Harris beating that was mentioned earlier in your broadcast, but simply the murder of Heather Heyer, I think that, you know, he sends another clear message to white supremacists that, again, you have a friend in the White House. I'm not going to be nearly as tough on you as my predecessor.
Still with us is Zach Roberts, freelance photojournalist, told us about the beating of the young black man just mentioned by Jamil Smith. Were people on the left also armed, people from Black Lives Matter, people from Antifa, the anti-fascist organization?
In no way, shape, and form the same way that the white supremacists were. I did see a handful of, if you heard of things about people getting sprayed with water bottles and stuff like that, like they may have thrown water bottles. But other than literally occasionally picking up a pole, one of the wooden, like heavy wooden dowels that that the white supremacists were carrying, and the like you see in the photos, if you look online, of DeAndre Harris's beating, the ones that they were hitting with, occasionally they would pick up that, but I never witnessed any attacks with any sort of weapons or of any kind from I'll say the left, including kind of everybody.
Jamil Smith, in the late 60s, I covered a news conference of Stokely Carmichael with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and everybody who was guarding him in the room with the press, this was in Washington, D.C., had a gun. Do you think the left is going to arm in order to defend itself against what we're hearing is a new form of racist conservatives?
Well, I don't know necessarily about the left, but I definitely know that there is a substantial increase in interest and purchases of guns from the black communities throughout the United States. I mean, you're seeing a lot of people understanding that there's a rise in this exact kind of white supremacist violence, and they're looking to protect themselves. They're looking to educate themselves about guns. They're going to gun ranges. They're taking classes. They're purchasing the weapons. So you're seeing that people are not just fearful of sort of the, normal crime that, folks are, used to dealing with, but they're also looking to make sure that these white supremacists who have essentially been given license by this president throughout his campaign and now as president to do what they're doing, they're making sure that they're able to protect themselves. Now, guns aren't for everybody, obviously. I grew up in a house with guns, but I don't like them. That said, I think that, there are a lot of people who are investigating their Second Amendment rights, and we'll see how the right defends that. You see already the NRA refusing to defend Philando Castile, a young licensed gun owner who was pulled over in Minneapolis last year and shot dead by police when he was trying to, after he informed the officer that he had the gun. So even having guns doesn't make us safer. I think Philando Castile shows that. I think the right has shown that they're not willing to defend us, even if we do have a gun.
David French, back to you at the National Review, conservative that you are. You're in Tennessee. What do you make of the counter-protesters and the what we just heard from Jamil Smith, that black people are buying guns, learning to protect themselves?
Well, first, I support lawful gun ownership. I think it's an important part of citizenship and an informed and responsible independent citizenry. I think it's an important aspect of that. And I think but we have to separate out here what happened in Charlottesville, which I think was unquestionably instigated by the alt-right, and the terrorist who drove into the crowd was an alt-right terrorist. And that's unmistakably clear at this point, and was one of the reasons why the president should have unmistakably called that out. Let's separate out that and also talk about a larger context of political violence in the United States. We're not where we were in the late 60s and early 70s yet, and I hope we don't ever get there again. But there have been riots in Berkeley. There have been riots in other cities in the United States. And there is a sense amongst an awful lot of people that we are in a tinderbox situation. And one of the things that I think is incredibly important here is it's incredibly important for law enforcement to remember its first duty, which is to protect the liberty of this of the citizens, of this country's citizens. And that's why it's so disturbing to have, see many of these reports of stand-down orders. There have been reports of stand-down orders in Berkeley. There have been severe beatings of innocent bystanders by Antifa protesters in places like Berkeley. There have been melees between alt-right and Antifa in places like Sacramento where people are getting hurt, nearly killed. It is vitally important, if we're going to not be a tinderbox, that law enforcement step up, start to separate these protesters, separate these violent elements, and protect liberty. And unfortunately, when we're seeing these street melees, that's not liberty. That is anarchy. And it was only a matter of time before somebody was going to die. And this is something I think is deeply disturbing and should unite people across the political spectrum, that it's time for law enforcement to do what it needs to do to prevent these kinds of battles, if at all possible.
The president has been so insistent that others, particularly Democrats, and he certainly said this about President Obama when he was in office, should denounce Muslim terrorism. And he has said that again and again. Should he speak out against domestic terrorism? Is that what we saw in Charlottesville?
Well, obviously it was domestic terrorism. And I think that truth is a value no matter who's, no matter how the truth cuts. And the truth of the matter was, from all the available evidence that we have, was this was an alt-right, a member of the alt-right, who mowed down a group of innocent civilians. And that's unacceptable and has to be very specifically called out in the same way that radical Islamic terror has to be very specifically called out. The truth matters here. We can't obscure truth for the sake of certain larger narratives or political tribalism. We have to unflinchingly look at what actually happened. And that's one of the reasons why the president's statement on Saturday was so disappointing. It wasn't just the blandness of it. It was the contrast between the blandness of the statement and the extreme specificity he uses when he's actually truly angry at somebody. Like, just ask the Khan family, or Judge Curiel, or his own attorney general, or the former FBI director. He knows exactly how to specifically call people out, and he chose not to do so. And that is very deeply troubling. It's better that he did it today, but it was very deeply troubling Saturday when he did not.
Back to Ruth Ben-Ghiat, the history professor at NYU. Again, you studied fascism in Europe, and you're seeing something here that you find very disturbing. Elaborate a bit on what we have heard since the last time you were able to speak to us about what do you see developing here with this very well-organized new right-wing racist organization and the way the police are responding, the stand-downs that David French just talked about?
Well, one of the things that is so disturbing, if you do the historical parallels, and I don't think that we're going to have a fascist dictatorship, a one-party state, those are things of the past. However, in these very volatile situations, when the state authorities that people have come to trust, some people anyway, are absent or passive and they allow violence to fester, that is never a good situation. Now, it's complicated because we have a head of state who plays this game we've all described. And so I agree with what's been said about it. It's a kind of moment of reckoning. And I see this as, you know, many things coming to coalesce. You have this long-standing game of racism that the GOP has played, and now Jeff Sessions comes and says, oh, we have to renounce these things. But as we speak, they're continuing voter suppression, and no one is fooled about, you know, these things. And then you have this larger problem, which isn't going away, that what is fueling these alt-right participants is their worry about white identity being stifled. And Their apocalypse is the demographic shifts in the U.S., which are going to make America a minority-majority country in a few decades. And so one angle that doesn't get you know, talked about enough is that they are looking, and this is different than the old KKK, these people look to Russia, right? Putin has emerged as the great white hope of this global right. And so these people are not only nationalists, they're kind of globalists. Right. In the meantime, they're acting on the ground, and we have these situations like Charlottesville. But these are larger historical forces which are coalescing, which are not going away. They're only getting worse.
Let me go back to Jamil Smith, again, our political journalist, contributing writer for The Daily Beast. What about identity politics, and to what extent has identity politics on the part of African Americans and Latinos and Asians and others contributed, do you think, to the fear of whites that they are, in fact, going to be suppressed and once again, no longer the majority? That's already the case in Los Angeles.
Well, I don't know if I can speak to how it's made them fearful necessarily, because I don't fear that fear is legitimate. I mean, look, they like to position race as a zero-sum game. If some people gain rights, that means that they lose rights. Well, that's not actually how it works. White privilege in this country and all the advantages that are sort of baked into what America is, the American project itself, is not about necessarily, you know, handing like a certain limited set of rights. Everyone should have rights, all of them. Everyone should be equal. All people are asking is to be put on the same level playing field. And what we now have is an administration that is dedicated to doing the work of white supremacy by, you know, backing voter purges, by encouraging more police violence, by working to kill family funding for Planned Parenthood, you know, that primary benefits poor women of color. So I'm really less concerned about their feelings of persecution than I am the reality of systemic racism in this country.
We'll come back to you, Jamil Smith, and our other guests in just a moment, but we do need to take a break for our stations. And once again, it'll be very brief, and we'll be right back with To the Point from PRI.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
We're not only back with To the Point. Once again, talking about the aftermath of the situation in Charlottesville, and Jamil Smith is with us, a political journalist and a contributing writer for A Daily Beast, talking a moment ago about the issue of identity politics. There are those in the Democratic Party who are saying that they have to move away from identity politics, because if they don't, then they will lose substantial numbers of white voters forever. What do you say to that?
I say that that's nonsense. I think that's actually political suicide. The Democrats, in this new launch of what they call a better deal, have proceeded to, essentially tell everyone that they want to divorce themselves from identity politics, that they want to concentrate exclusively on economics. Well, they're missing an opportunity to tell, frankly, the truth to the American people that identity politics are economic politics, that economics involve all aspects of identity. If you can tell me that abortion or immigration are not economic issues, then I'd love to hear that argument. But I think that, frankly, it's just not valid. And the Democrats, instead of making their argument and emboldening the base that they already have, women, people of color, they are instead casting the concerns of that demographic aside and chasing after people who have plainly rejected their ideas and their philosophies. I don't understand it, frankly, and I wrote as much.
Explain how abortion is an economic issue as well as a moral one.
Okay, well, if a woman who has a woman has children and she gets pregnant, decides that she's not able to afford the child care or whatever, however much it pay, you know, costs to have a child, or say she's lost her insurance, then it becomes an economic issue. Say she lives in an area of, say, Texas, where there are no abortion clinics, and she is forced then to you know, carry the child to term, and then she's, you know, unable to care for that child, then it's an economic issue. If you talk about how it's disproportionately affecting different communities, say a poor community who aren't able to afford abortions, say, you know, abortion's perfectly legal, like here in California, and that person is just simply not able to afford the procedure, it's an economic issue. There's so many different ways that reproductive choice, you know, intercedes and, you know, intersects with economics. I think people need to understand that these policies aren't just about morality. They are about, you know, the kitchen table stuff that we all like to talk about.
David French, are the people who participated on the side of the racists in Charlottesville largely young men who also have economic issues that they are concerned about?
You know, I think when you're dealing with extremists, we often overemphasize the economic angle. I mean, these are people who are persuaded by a particular philosophy. And that philosophy, the broader philosophy of the alt-right, is that civilization is inseparable from race and that the Western civilization is inseparable from the white race. That's the broader philosophy that they're empowered by and that they're acting on. And so I'm always skeptical of arguments that look at small numbers and extremists and say if we deal with underlying economic issues, they'll go away. We have extremists in this country. We've had extremists in this country. And part of the resonance and power of the internet, sadly, has been directed towards generating more of them. Now, as far as larger, more mainstream arguments within American society, economics and identity politics are absolutely key and core, as well as morality. So, you know, as I'm hearing a discussion of abortion as a moral, as a economic issue, I'm thinking, well, as a pro-life conservative, that making it easier to pay the bills or to finish an education isn't a reason to kill another human being. And so we're talking about deep and fundamental moral issues here beyond economics. So, but when it comes to the actual extremists themselves, I think it's very easy to overdo the economic argument.
Quickly, Zach Roberts, our photojournalist who was in the midst of the situation in Charlottesville, how would you describe those people who seem to be so well organized, so militaristic, paying attention to planning that had occurred apparently beforehand, responding to leaders that had walkie-talkies and doing what they were told? Who were those people? Did they all look the same?
It's kind of a loaded question. Do white supremacists all?
Well, certainly they were white. There's no question about that. But were they college? Were they college graduate looking, or were they?
I'm writing a piece for Nation of Change right now, and I believe I coined the term "fascists in comfortable shoes." So these are people who normally, maybe 30 years ago, they'd be wearing the jack boots. They'd be wearing, you know, Doc Martens of, you know, the old days. But, you know, these are polo shirt wearing, you know, white supremacists. This is the culture. I really don't like blaming it, you know, because it's been long before Donald Trump, but like, this is the culture that, Donald Trump, Jeff Sessions, and this culture of, voter suppression, another issue I work on all the time with Chris Kobach, that have been brought out of the weeds and given prominence, and now they feel like they can march down the middle of the street and scream at racial epithets at citizens of the town that they're in, and not expect any sort of police response or any sort of response. They actually complained to me about how tough the police were on them. As you know, yes.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we have a couple of minutes left, and we have one right-leaning commentator, one left-leaning commentator. David French, Conservative National Review. I'll start with you. Take a minute to tell us what ought to be done. David French, you still with us? Oh, apparently we lost him. Jamil Smith, your turn. Tell us what we should do.
Well, what needs to be done, first of all, is, first, all of the folks who committed suspected civil rights crimes over the course of the weekend should be prosecuted, number one. That should be called domestic terrorism and prosecuted as such.
Quickly, Zach Roberts, was anybody arrested except for the—
Actually, I wanted to very quickly make that point. I have offered my photos to the Charlottesville Police Department. I've at least on Twitter and other places offered it to FBI. I've heard no response. DeAndre has not heard any response as well from the Charlottesville Police Department. And currently, you know, it's taken to Twitter to name people that people see in the photos that I took.
All right, Jamil Smith, but let me let you continue then. Sorry to interrupt.
No, not a problem. First and second of all, the statues need to be removed. All of these Confederate monuments need to be removed. It's not just about the fact that it's morally right to do so. It's about the fact that now we're seeing that these are now focal points for white supremacist terrorism. These folks are using it as an excuse to meet up and to cause this kind of ruckus and violence. So they need to be removed, and they need to be removed quickly. And white supremacy needs to be treated as a public safety issue, not just as a moral wrong.
Zach Roberts, you cover a lot of these incidents. You have been to many. Do we know what's next?
Well, thankfully, it looks like the Boston, quote-unquote free speech rally has just been canceled, at least by Gavin. I believe it was Gavin McManus was organizing it. He says it's canceled. There's been, but, you know, August 31st is the, I believe, the date for the hearing for the General Lee statue that supposedly all of this is about. So whether or not Charlottesville is going to have another meeting with this, and hopefully we can only hope that the police department and the officials are a little bit more prepared and ready to confront violent white supremacists in their streets.
So, Jamil Smith, presumably you buy that one.
Yes. I hope that they actually do make the right decision this time. But at the same time, you also understand that there's going to be a rally in Berkeley on August 27th as well. So there's potential for more violence there. The key is that we cannot fall into this frame that the president first put out, that many sides are responsible for this. We need to understand that, you know, who is provoking this, who is starting this fight, and why that's important that these people are starting this fight.
All right. We're out of time. I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Jamil Smith, again, with The Daily Beast. Zach Roberts, photojournalist who has covered the white supremacists in Charlottesville and many other similar incidents. David French with The National Review, conservative magazine. Ruth Ben-Ghiat, history professor at NYU. And A.C. Thompson, the reporter for ProPublica, who started our show. Thanks as well to Glenn Thrush of the New York Times. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.